If you have your Bibles, turn to the book of Nehemiah. We've been working through a series called A People Rebuilt. And so what this has been is just kind of a reminder of really God's promise to all of us that he is creating us to be a people that is worthy of him and called to serve him. Last night was the closing ceremonies of the Invictus Games. I don't know if anybody has watched this or knows anything about it. But the Invictus Games was a brainchild of Prince Harry and his burden for service women and men who've been broken through the ravages of war, whether it be physical, psychological, or mental brokenness as a result of war. People who've come back and in many ways have no longer a country to serve or no way to represent and serve their country. And so through his burden, he created the Invictus Games. And it's a series of, it's kind of like an Olympics for these service women and men. 15 countries were represented, and they go through various games like archery or indoor rowing or swimming, cycling, sitting volleyball, wheelchair basketball, golf, powerlifting, wheelchair tennis, wheelchair rugby, all these kinds of things that these people are able to work towards something and get on the world stage again and represent the country that they love with what they have. And it's become a way of bonding again with a group of brothers and sisters around a cause. I found it interesting how Prince Harry described what the purpose of these games were. He says this. He said it in various press conferences or whatever, but this is what he says. These games have been about seeing guys sprinting for the finish line and then turning around to clap the last man in. They've been about teammates choosing to cross the line together, not wanting to come second, but not wanting the other guys to either. These games have shown the very best of the human spirit. What is he doing? He's rebuilding a broken generation, a broken people. If you ever talk with somebody who's in the military or who has served in this way, this is a band of brothers, as we've heard in other series. This is a family that they belong to. It's a people that they belong to that have been bonded together by a purpose beyond themselves. Harry, who has served in the military, was eventually exposed and had to come back from, I think it was Afghanistan. He's always had a burden for this group of people. And so he created the Invictus Games to rebuild a broken generation. That's what Nehemiah sees. He sees broken people, people who no longer are bonded together by the very essence of God, something beyond themselves. And so Nehemiah sees this broken generation, and he calls them back to that which bonds them together. Again, something beyond themselves. And that is representing God on the world stage. And so chapter 1, he responds to the ruin. He calls them together. And in chapter 2, we see that he starts to act as God leads. This morning, I want to talk about him rallying the team to action. How does he get to everybody together so that everyone grabs the trowel, as it were, and begins this rebuilding process? It's just not for anybody either. I intentionally put the team. It's a definite article. It's just not rallying a team. It's rallying the team. Somebody rallying together the people that God has touched and planted this holy discontent in, who's willing to follow through with commitment on what's been put before them as a people. And so a challenge for us this morning is, are we on the team? Have we been captivated by a holy discontent? Not a church building, not a bunch of great church ministries, not having the coolest band or the nicest worship time or the best songs or whatever makes a church these days. But are we rallying around a vision? Be thou my vision. Be the center. Be my vision, as we sang. A direction that God has given. Details for what we're supposed to do as a people. The roles that each of you are supposed to play, the responsibilities that we have to one another and ultimately to God, committing to a team committing to a vision that's beyond ourselves, and serving with a sense of certainty of where it's going to go. The problem with most teams, though, is that the needs that people rally around are not necessarily the call. You know, you can't go to No Frills or Walmart today with having a need put before you. Would you like to donate a dollar to the Boys and Girls Clubs of Wetaskiwin? Oh, okay, well, every place I go, they're asking for another dollar. Or I'm getting a phone call by Compassion Canada or World Vision or somebody. There's millions of needs. There's thousands of needs around us. Many of them are urgent. They're probably all or most of them are legitimate. We can't do them all. I can't fund them all. I can't participate in them all. So which one do we commit to? What do we get involved in? What's our call amongst the abundance of needs around us? I want to ask you a question. Has God ever put something in your heart that you had to stew on, that you allowed to sink in, to become part of your DNA? Something that just kind of stirred you for a long time. It wasn't a fad. Wasn't kind of the latest thing to get involved in. But it was something that never faded again over time. That it just grew and grew. Have you ever allowed God to do that something to you? That's what happened to Nehemiah. Chapter 1, we waited for 4 months before doing anything. Before speaking to anybody, he prayed, he fasted, he stewed on it. It sunk in, it became a part of who he was. This is the biblical story. Abraham, mentioned him already, the promise that through his descendants, which he never thought he could have, God's going to create a people. He waited 25 years before Isaac was born. Moses had a sense that God was going to call him to lead his people. It was about 40 years before he went to Pharaoh to bring Israel out of Egypt. Joseph had a dream at age 12 that his family, his brothers, are going to bow down before him. And he told them about it. Probably not a good thing to do because they sold him. But he waited 22 years before his brothers bowed before him. I think of David. How early David was chosen by Samuel to be the king of Israel. Yet he played for King Saul. He led him in music. He you know, dodged spears. There was a plot to kill him. And he waited. 2 Samuel is all about David waiting for God's timing for the kingdom to be given to him. Jesus, at age 12, was found in the temple, and he said to his parents, well, where else am I going to be? I'm here doing my father's business. Yet it wasn't until age 30 that he actually started his ministry. He waited 18 years. Paul first started Saul. He has this incredible revelation of on the road to Damascus, and he sees Jesus, and he's called to be an apostle to the Gentiles, yet he went away for 12 years to be mentored and trained. And then he became the missionary to the Gentiles. What was happening during all these times? Maybe a call was growing, was stirring, was being planted within them. What we see in all these people and with Nehemiah, and what we really need to learn is that the needs that are often put before us isn't necessarily the call. And that when the call comes, it's not the work that matters. It's actually you. God cares way more about the worker than the work. And if we think about the church, we are really good at focusing on the work. We're really good at reaching ministries, putting together food hampers and reaching a need like at Lakedale, which is, of course, important. That's what we're called to do. But what is God really about? Is he about building the wall? No. He's about building a people and changing lives and changing your life, giving you a sense of security and hope and certainty in life. God's taking broken people and making them whole. He's planting holy discontents among people like us so that we go out and serve a purpose that's beyond us. He's leading us to act strategically, as we talked about last week. God is working to form a people. Myrna and I were having an interesting conversation this week. We I forget how it started, but she was just telling me about an interaction she had with somebody in our community, friends through the school and so on. And you know, we get along well. I think they kind of like us, and I guess we're relatively normal. But she noticed that the second anything spiritual comes up, they get kind of squirrely and weird. And it's like, well, maybe they were hurt by a church one time. And we went, oh, yeah, you mean like, oh, yeah, and also, oh, yeah, and remember them too. And we just started going through a list of people in our community that we've known through school, through sports and stuff, who want nothing to do with this because of their story of being hurt in a church. Is it possible that the church has been so focused on work, doing things? You come in this way. This is a proper way to behave. You need to dress this way. We don't do that here. And all the while, we're hurting people. We're more focused on the work. God is more focused on the worker. He's interested in you, in changing your life, inspiring you about who you've been created to be, to serve a purpose that literally changes the lives of other people. Yet you might be here thinking, I'm not doing anything, or I'm doing this ministry, and I hope people like it. God's more interested in the worker. And so the book of Nehemiah has nothing to do with building of the wall and building the temple and making Jerusalem secure and look pretty. It's about God's people being worthy of having his name. And so this morning for us as a church, is God building you? Is he changing you? Is he refining you? Is he bonding us together? Is he inspiring us to a vision, a calling that has nothing to do with us, but has everything to do with changing our community and being a light? And so as we look at Nehemiah this morning, we're going to see that as God stirs his heart and as God stirs your heart, he's preparing others to partner with you. He's preparing others to partner with us. And that's another very unusual thing in the North American church. We're a bunch of lone rangers. How many people know your story? How many people have you shared your life with? Your joys, your challenges. How many people have you shared a sense of call with? We've been designed to partner together as God stirs our heart towards one vision. We all have different roles. We'll talk about that in a second. But there's a call that he has for us as a people. So Nehemiah has found an open door to go now from Susa to Jerusalem. And he went there. So that's where we ended last week. Verse 9, it says, so I went. He had the letters of approval. He had opportunities to go. And so he goes. He comes across some opposition, or he hears about it. But in verse 11, where we're starting this morning, he goes. I went to Jerusalem, and after staying there for 3 days, I set out during the night with a few men. I had not told anyone what my God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem. Interestingly, and how does he build his team? How does he rally people around a cause? Interestingly, he stays quiet at first. He doesn't tell anybody. And there's something about that, that we're to remain silent. What is he doing for those 3 days? He doesn't really say to us. Maybe he was tired from the journey. Maybe he was taking care of some personal affairs in Jerusalem. Or maybe there was this group of men that he was confiding in and processing with. And maybe this vision is growing deeper. I think that's what was happening. He was taking time to discern this, to think through it, to organize his thoughts. He remains silent. Now think about today. You get an idea, most likely it's on Facebook within the hour, or you've tweeted it. I don't tweet. I don't even know what that means. But anyways, you tweet it, Twitter it, you tweet it, you Snapchat it, or whatever it is you do. We immediately put it out there. Hey, this is what I'm doing today. This is what my life is for. This is what I'm thinking about. Have you ever put something out in the public forum and went, oh, I shouldn't have done that? You know, pull it back. Have you ever done that? All of us have. Nehemiah waits. He processes. I have not told anyone what God That's a key word there. God has put in my heart. Have you ever had good ideas that later on didn't kind of sound so good? I had one for this morning, by the way, that I was going to put in the sermon. And even asked Myrna about it. Hey, what do you think about this? She didn't really like it. A little hurt by that. I was like, well, I walked away and went, oh, I'm so glad I didn't follow through with that. Because it was Chris's idea. God put this on my heart. How do you know that? Nehemiah waits. He processes. He prays. He fasts. And so for a time, he remains quiet. That's the beginning of building a team, to make sure the team is not about you. But then he also builds a core leadership. This is not always a popular thing in leadership, but it's important. And it's just these three little words that really no one is able to process. I haven't read much about it, but I think it's here for a reason. I set out during the night with a few men. He developed an inner circle. Some people he could confide with, probably people who were helping him process what he was about. Probably people who were confirming and refining the vision. Probably people who were encouraging him, who were challenging him. Hey, Nehemiah, have you thought about this? An inner circle was so important. I mean, the greatest example is Jesus. Jesus had an inner circle of disciples. More often than not, he was refining and changing and training them and sending them out to be the light of the world. Paul had Barnabas, he had Timothy, he had a diakonios, which is like a servant group around him, deacons, that they served together. He had groups of elders with him. He had an inner circle that in many of his letters he alludes to with so much affection. We need to, each of us, have a core team around us that really have license to speak into your life. And so he brings this group together, and he goes out, and he begins to discover the whole picture. Have you ever not done something because you don't have the full picture? What's this going to look like? I don't get all the pieces, so I'm not going to participate in it. It's interesting, in chapter 1 and chapter 2, he does have that picture before he acts. He knows what he's going to do, restore the wall. He knows all the different places he has to pass through and the permission he needs to get to go there. But when he gets to Jerusalem, now he's blind. He doesn't know what the next step is. He doesn't know the big picture. And so with this trusted group of people, he goes out to discover it before he rallies the troops. Verse 13. By night, I went out through the valley gate toward the jackal well and the dung gate, examining the walls of Jerusalem, which had been broken down, and its gates, which had been destroyed by fire. Then I moved toward the fountain gate and the king's pool, and there was not enough room for my mount, there was probably a donkey, to get through. So I went up the valley by night, examining the wall. Finally, I turned back and re-entered through the valley gate. So probably for all of us, that really doesn't make a lot of sense. We're going to explore that a little bit more next week, what all those places were. But what was he doing? He was traveling around the perimeter of Jerusalem and inspecting what was going on. He was taking stock of the destruction. So again, many years before, the Babylonians had come and destroyed Jerusalem, probably from the north, and broken down the wall and burned things. Everything was destroyed, and Nehemiah's taking stock of what was going on and what's going to be required of him and his team and rallying the people together to rebuild this. He was discovering the whole picture, how to rally people, how to mobilize them, even where to place them and how to mobilize them. I've talked before about, how do we discover our place in service? And so for some of you crazy people who like to do jigsaw puzzles, I've used the analogy of, you have a puzzle piece. I'm allowed to call you crazy because my wife is one of them, okay? So I've kind of said, you have a puzzle piece, and it's got a defined shape to it. And it fits in line with pieces around you. And so part of our process of being a Christ follower is what gifts do I have? What place do I have? God, what do you want me to do? When am I supposed to be placed? So again, you people who do this, you start with a perimeter and you kind of work in. But what's another thing that you do? You have the box sitting in front of you. You have the whole picture in front of you to act on and to work off of and slowly put all these pieces together. There might be a better analogy that has actually started to speak to me over the last several years, and it's one of a painting. You know, I marvel at people who can do oil paintings. One, because I don't have that gift at all, and they produce these incredible pictures. But more so in the process of making it. And so, I mean, I've watched people do it, or I've seen it on TV or whatever, and you watch these individual brush strokes. And I don't understand how the artist can go from the picture on the right, the brush strokes, and how they can make it to look like what's on the left. When you zoom in and you see the individual brush stroke, it just looks like a gob of paint to me. And they keep moving around and mixing it. And then they bring in another color and they keep sloshing this stuff together. And all of a sudden, these different brush strokes come together to form this incredible picture. And that might be a better image of what it's like to be a part of the church. Because you are a brush stroke. And you're not just one little piece that's got all these little defined boundaries to it, but you're actually a stroke that starts to interact with others. And it's the interaction and the different hues and the colors that the master painter is moving around to form a picture that when we zoom in to look at the individual strokes, we just can't see. Quite frankly, I just don't see, you know, where we're going all the time. I don't get that. I don't know the picture that he's painting. But I do know what one stroke looks like. I know what one brush looks like. I know what it looks like for two or three people to come together and interact together. And through them, this picture starts to emerge. So discovering the bigger picture is a big process. Nehemiah didn't know exactly what it was going to look like, but he did take stock of what God wanted to do. He did know the master's heart and how he was going to bring all these strokes together to form an image, a picture, a people that's worthy of him. And so he starts to discover this whole picture. And then finally, at the end of this, he calls people together. And so he calls them to action. After doing this, verse 16, he kind of sets the stage for this call. Up until this point, he says, the officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, because as yet I had said nothing to the Jews or the priests or nobles or officials or any others who would be doing the work. That sets the stage. He's remained silent. Then I said to them, you see the trouble we're in. Jerusalem lies in ruins and its gates have been burned and with fire. Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem and we will no longer be in disgrace. I also told them about the gracious hand of God upon me and what the king had said to me. They replied, let us start rebuilding. So they began this good work. Notice how he goes back to the holy discontent. The words that he uses in 17 is very similar to chapter 1, verse 3. Trouble, ruin, disgrace, gates burned. He puts before them the vision that has captured his heart, the specifics that need to be accomplished, that this needs to be rebuilt. He even talks about the certainty of it actually happening. God is going to make this happen. The gracious hand of God is on us, is on me. He's put it there. Verse 18, he even brings his own personal testimony into this, that this has impacted my life in this way. He even opened the doors for me with the kings and so on. And this is God at work. And so that's the nature of his rally cry. It has nothing to do with me. It has everything to do with God's reputation and what he's doing, the open doors he is putting before us. You know, I try to invite people to do testimonies. We have something here called Food for the Journey. It's been quite a while since we've done one. But what it's meant to be is someone who comes up and says, this is my story. This is my testimony. This is how God's at work in my life. And it's so impactful to everybody around. It's like, wow, they're just like me. If God can speak to them, then maybe God wants to speak to me too. And in doing that, we kind of get bonded together. And so not only does Nehemiah put kind of God's vision, this thing that has touched his heart, but his own testimony out there as well. And then he extends an invitation. You know, come, let's build. We'll no longer be in disgrace. Again, he doesn't talk about insecurity. They were insecure. Armies could come and invade. But this has nothing to do with that. It has everything to do with being in disgrace. And really, this word disgrace means punishment, exile, shame. And so in this call, it grips people. And God has been working in them before Nehemiah said this, because what's their response? Let us do it. We're going to start this building project. We're going to actually do it. And we'll notice that at this point in the story, things change. It goes from Nehemiah saying first person, I, to the plural, we, us, they. Starting at the end, in, you know, verse 9, I went. Verse 11, I went. Verse 13, I went. Verse 14, I moved. Verse 13, I went. I turned back. I was doing. Verse 17, I said. Verse 18, let us. They began a good work. The team had been formed. But it took a leader who understood the calling, who let that grow and fester within him, take a good stock of what needs to be done, had an inner circle to confide in, to refine, and to challenge. And then he rallied the people, and everyone said yes. Not because he's a great leader, he was, but because God had been planting something in and among them. Those of you who were here for our vision meetings about 3 years ago, I've wanted to do Nehemiah since I came to this church. And I hadn't because I felt I wasn't supposed to. I wanted to do vision meetings as soon as I came, and we waited several years before I did. When the time came to do them, I confided in my inner circle some of the things that I think we needed to move towards as a church. I even used some of the strategies I had learned through my leadership courses. When it came time to the meetings, and you all started your conversations and started reporting back to the whole group what God had been placing on the hearts of the people at your table, I sat down. I had nothing to say. Because God had been moving you towards where we needed to go, and he didn't need my fancy words and my leadership and my planning to get you there. We are here today where we are as a church, not because I'm a great leader or we have great leadership, and hopefully those are the cases, but he was planting something in you to make Pastor Andrew a reality, to make the youth center a reality, to make some changes to the programming and other things that we're doing a reality. It wasn't me. It was God partnering and working with people like you to bring us together to a vision that has rallied us together. And so we're a good example of just God at work, restoring people, using people to change the lives of people. Now, some of you might be struggling with, what's the application of all this to me? I'm not a Nehemiah. I'm not going to pioneer some big ministry. I'm not going to lead some big team. I'm not going to have this grandiose vision beyond myself. And so how does this really apply to me? Well, first of all, you're a part of a people. If you're sitting here, you're a part of something beyond yourself. If you're a person created in God's image, God plants a holy discontent in you. He has. Whether you're choosing to embrace it or not is up to you. You've been called to mourn for these things. You've been called to fast and pray for them. You've been called and invited to participate in changing other people's lives. You've been invited to be a part of a body, a team like this. Now, if you're a leader, you need to be legitimate. You need to earn the right and the trust of people who are going to follow you. If you're a leader, you need to plan well. You need to be informed well, have a team around you. You need to be ready to face opposition. If you're a follower, that's an incredible gift, to be a good follower. A good follower equips the leader. A good follower catches the leader's vision and affirms it and directs it. A good follower has hands that are ready to get dirty. and to engage and to participate. A good follower doesn't get discouraged when opposition comes. That might be you. All of us living together, there's a huge danger. And there's a danger that Nehemiah came across here. And that is people living in rubble getting used to it. People who are in disgrace and who are living in a disaster, living there so long that it becomes normal. And that's the church. That's my discontent. That even when things are going well, we think, well, it could be worse. And the dysfunction that we have becomes normal. Nehemiah puts before them, we're in trouble. Folks, we're in trouble. Our cultures are in trouble. Our kids are in trouble. Our schools, our families, our communities are in trouble. They're in ruins. Things have been burned down. Come, let us rebuild people. Let's let people become discontent with the dysfunction that they live in. That's all of us. And so moving forward, these people say, yeah, we're in. Let's go. My hands are going to get dirty. We will build this wall. And so in verse 19, they come across the opposition again. But when Sanballat and the Horonite and Tobiah, the Ammonite official, and Geshem, someone new, the Arab, heard about it, they mocked and ridiculed us. What is this you're doing, they asked. Are you rebelling against the king? The more we do things, the more we are a part of what God's doing, the stronger the opposition. We've been introduced to these guys before. We're going to look at them a little bit more later. But one thing we notice here is before they were disturbed about what was going on, they were threatened by the presence of Nehemiah and the building of the wall. In 19, they actually start to get aggressive and they start to rebuke people. They start to challenge people. They spread lies. Why? Because they're dysfunctional. And when people get healthy and people move on into what God has for them, healthy people become a threat to dysfunctional people. And we've had that here. As we get healthy, those who are not healthy are uncomfortable. And so we need to be prepared for that. When we get called to action, we need to be prepared for that. But God gives us a sense of assurance as we move forward. And so we just need to start to participate, engage as a people. And when we do, the hope that we have is that when people work, God completes. It's that simple. You don't need to complete anything on your own, under your own power. And so these guys are saying, you know, what are you doing? This isn't going to work. What makes you think that you can complete this task? Verse 20, Nehemiah answers them by saying, the God of heaven will give us success. We, his servants, will start rebuilding. But as for you, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right to it. Two things we see here. Nehemiah answers this challenge in two ways. First of all, in a spiritual way. And this openly happens because of the time he's taken. Spiritually, he says, this is not a human enterprise. You're right, I can't do it. But God has put this in our hearts. He, the God of heaven, is going to make this a success. Nehemiah is saying he's completely dependent on the power of God. And this is another thing missing in the church. Why are we hurting so many people as churches? It's because it's a human enterprise. It's about me. It's about my success. It's about me getting the credibility for success and the affirmation. Nehemiah says this has nothing to do with me. Has everything to do with him. But then on the practical side, he says, we're going to build it. We're going to get our hands dirty. We're going to start engaging in this, whatever it takes to do it. We're building. And in chapter 3, we see that Nehemiah puts together 42 teams that through their muscle and their sweat, driven by a heart, changed by God, they accomplish the task. This is no different than what Jesus calls us to do and to be. You know, so often we worry, I worry, about practical needs around me, about the logistics of this place and connecting with you people and so on. And Jesus said, that's not your job. That's not your responsibility. That's my job. And so when he talks to a crowd on the Sermon on the Mount, he says, this is what you're supposed to focus on. Seek first the kingdom. This is the spiritual side. This is the God of the universe doing what only the God of the universe can do. And that's change people's lives. Open doors. Seek that. That has nothing to do with you. By the way, you can't do it anyway. Seek that. And his righteousness. That's something that you can allow happen in your life. Engage in the spiritual disciplines. Join a community in which God can speak into your life. Seek that. And when you do that, all the other things that we worry about will be given to you. God completes his task. So what do we do moving forward? Something that's just really hit me this week is just take a step. For some of you, take another step. For some of you, you've never taken a step. You've been sitting here for a while, or maybe you're relatively new to all this, and you've been pondering, maybe I need to give my life to something beyond me. Maybe this God is real. Maybe Jesus truly was the Son of God. Maybe there's something to the cross, and it's actually historical. Maybe there is something to sin, and that there is an eternal consequence for me. Maybe that's a step that God is leading you to take, is accepting Christ as truly the only Savior. For some of you, you've taken that step, but maybe you haven't taken anything else. So maybe take another step. That's all you need to worry about. You don't need to worry about all of the other things that have to happen down the road. Just take another step. As I was watching the closing ceremonies of the Invictus Games last night, Prince Harry put that challenge out to people going home. He said, Invictus means unconquerable. You are unconquered people. Which means you have anything before you. You can do anything. Of course, that's our culture's message. And so he says to them, when you go home, it's going to be really hard. And so I'm going to challenge you with one thing. And I was amazed when he said this because I was kind of reviewing my sermon. He says, I want you to go home and start something. It doesn't matter how big your next step will be. Just take it. I thought, perfect analogy for tomorrow. Folks, we just need to take it. Why? If Prince Harry can tell a group of soldiers who've been maimed in war that they are unconquered, how much more for a church who's literally received the Spirit of God? How much more for us who, when we look at the stars, we look at the universe, we look at the global church, we look at some of our own lives, the unconquerable movement, conquerable movement of God, and him saying, Brightview, this is what I have for you. Why can't we take a step? As individuals or as a church, we just need to take a step because we are Invictus. If you look at the t-shirts of all of these athletes, it says Invictus, and in the middle, it was in the previous picture, it says, I am. I am Invictus. I am unconquered. Man, that's the rally of the church. We are unconquered because we are followers of Jesus Christ. So just take a step. There's a song that I really like by Stephen Curtis Chapman called Take Another Step. And I wanted to, the song kind of says that over and over, but I wanted to say just kind of read to you the bridge, because it spoke a lot to me. If there's an ocean in front of you, you know what you've got to do. Take another step and another step. Maybe he'll turn water into dry land, referring to Moses. And maybe he'll take you by the hand and say, let's take a walk on the waves. Will you trust me either way? Take another step. Take another step. I don't know what God's put before you. I don't know what discontent he's planted in your heart. But I know you're not the only one. Taking time for it to grow roots and to either be removed or to deepen. If it's being deepened and God's calling you into something, you're not the only one. He's building a team to be a part of that. And he's calling you just to take a step. If you do that, I encourage you to continue and build into your faith community. Many of you are here, but not connected. When you discover the big picture, you discover where you fit, and you realize that the people around you are those that God has put in your life to interact with. God has put a few men, few women in your life for you to share a vision, to bring accountability, to gain support and encouragement, to get advice from. It's the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, and the others that we read in this passage that God has also planted this vision in. And the we, the us, the they will come together to build and to renew. Honestly, I'm going through this series because in a few months I'll be leaving for 5 months on a sabbatical. This has challenged me. God has challenged me a lot because this isn't my work. This isn't my church. This isn't my people. This is his. And so more and more I'm starting to hand things over and let things go. But what's going to make it happen is if you as a people take a step and build into one another as a community. And when we do that, you will be an unstoppable force. It doesn't matter whether I'm here or whatever. It's because it's a movement defined by the call of God. So build into one another as a faith community. And when you do that, you'll discover a role. And I encourage you to embrace that role. What does God want you to do? Are you a Nehemiah who is to rally a team? Are you a follower who is to equip your leaders and get your hands dirty? Are you part of the us starting the building? Hey, let us do it. We're in. Where do I start? Each one of us has to do a part. Hence, me leaving again. Everyone needs to do their part because this isn't Chris's church. It's not the board's church or anything like that. It's yours. This is your church. You are the body. And each one needs to do its part to build up the body to maturity. But as you embrace your role, as I've had to learn to embrace mine and know what I'm called to do, what I'm called not to do, we need to release responsibility for the outcome. Again, this is not my church. It's not my call for people to be changed because of me. I'm called to speak the truth. I'm called to love. I'm called to lead. I'm called to give a witness of what God has gripped my heart with. And I let it go. But I do this because the gracious hand of God has been on us. And, verse 20, I know the God of heaven will give us success. Because I'm not the only one. So many of you have come to be a part of the team to reach the vision of Brightview being a light in this community. And so in Nehemiah, we see the rally cry of bringing people together. And I want to ask you, are you on that team? Has God given you a holy discontent? Are you processing that? Are you willing to step in? Have you caught the vision? Are you willing to embrace your role? Connect with his community as a whole. And let's just let him bring us to success. We're going to close with a song of Be Thou My Vision. We've sung it before. Trust that it speaks in a new way to you. So as our worship team comes up, let's just pray and ask God to respond. Father, thank you for, again, Nehemiah, and just this story. After months of processing who you are and what you've called the people of God to be, what Jerusalem was, I thought he was a broken man, and he found opportunities and ways to return to Jerusalem. Yet really not knowing what to do from there, he took time to be informed, for you to speak into his life, to truly understand and believe that this is the hand of God at work. And God, that's where we are as a church. I don't know what the next year looks like. I know there's a job for us to do. And I know that we are the city on the hill, that we are the light of the world, that despite the history of other churches that have gone before us, God, we have opportunity to speak love and grace and truth in the lives of hurting people. So God, for us moving forward, I just pray that we, like Nehemiah, would be a broken people. That we'd see the hurt around us and it would just bring us to despair that people are walking without the assurance of you. And so, God, just help us to catch that. And I pray that as we leave here, we'll be willing to take just one step. It might be a giant leap for some, but whatever that step looks like, I pray that you'd make it clear to us, what does that be for me? What are you calling me to be? And out of my being, for with joy and excitement, God, what would you like me to do for your glory? It might be an ocean in front of us, but help us to have faith to step in and see if the water part and there's land there, or to grab you by the hand and walk on the water. Either way, we trust you. I pray that you'll build us into a community that is bound together by the finished work of Christ, and each one would do our part. But help us to believe that you are the God of all heaven and earth, and that you will give us success. Give us a vision that is beyond us. Protect us from those that will seek to speak lies into what we're about, who ridicule and will actively come in and thwart what we're about. Give us good leaders who will fight off wolves. Give us good followers to equip leaders and to do the work that we're all called to do. As we sing, I just pray that our lives, our minds, our hearts would be consistent with the words that we sing. And God, we'd be changed. Our communities would be changed. And we'll be a rebuilt people. Thank you for this time. And just guide us as we continue to worship now, as we receive the offering in just a moment too, just another act of worship. God, just take what we give, not because you need it, because it's an opportunity for us to give back to you what you've given us, for us to truly not be gripped by money and meeting our own needs, but first seeking first the kingdom and your righteousness. Pray this in your name and for your name's sake. Amen.